Today I am joined by Joanne Wicks QC of Wilberforce Chambers, a barrister who has risen to the very top of her profession. She is ranked in Band 1 of Leading Silks for Real Estate Litigation by Chambers & Partners 2019, which says she has the ability to cut through the issues and be pragmatic and commercial, and that she is an asset to any legal team and is an absolute pleasure to work with. The Legal 500 2019 edition describes her as trustworthy and reliable, as well as being technically excellent. She is also rated as one of the most highly regarded silks for real estate in Who's Who Legal UK Bar 2018, which says she's absolutely excellent. Joanne has joined us before to discuss a pair of high-profile cases she was involved in, but today the focus is more on her and her highly impressive career. Welcome back, Joanne.
Oh, thanks very much. Great to be here.
As I said, you're no stranger to our studio, having offered your insights on two of the most significant property cases of the last couple of years, in both of which you acted successfully for the winning party. So as we begin, I thought it might be interesting to revisit each of those decisions first, with the benefit of some months of reflection. So first, S. Francis versus Cavendish Hotel London Limited. Now, we've started to see the first decisions following in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Francis. So how significant, looking at the case now, do you think Francis has been, and what impact do you believe it will have going forward in the months and years to come?
Yeah, so you're right. We're starting to see decisions coming through. Some of them are applying the Francis test in other statutory contexts, where there's a similar test of intention, for example, under the Telecoms Code. And we're also starting to see the judges grapple with its application under the 54 Act in other cases. And it is clear that the impact has been significant. There's been a lot of talk about it in the industry. And what's been revealed, I think, is the extent to which landlords had previously been sort of beefing up their schemes with lots of work that they wouldn't otherwise have done just in order to satisfy the 54 Act test. So my feeling is, like a lot of important cases, there's probably likely to be a bit of a bulge of litigation as people get used to it, first of all. Obviously, the most difficult cases, in a way, are the ones that are already in the system because people have set their systems up and their schemes developed under the old law, as it were, and now they're having to adapt them. So there are likely to be a flurry of cases coming through as people get to grips with the practicalities. But then I think that things will calm down once the industry gets used to dealing with it in practice.
And then there was also Canary Wharf versus European Medicines Agency, a very high-profile case. When we last spoke, a potential appeal was very much on the cards. However, the EMA chose not to take the case to the Court of Appeal. As a result, the High Court decision stands. So do you think that brought certainty to the market on the much-discussed topic of Brexit and frustration?
Yes, I think having the appeal go and ensuring that the first instance decision is unchallenged has essentially reasserted the orthodox view that it's really, really difficult to frustrate a lease. If it had gone the other way, or whilst there was any realistic prospect of an appeal going the other way, then there was the potential to open up the possibility of lots of other tenants thinking, well, do you know what, Brexit's not so great for me, I think I ought to try and argue that my lease has been frustrated. But there are still other contracts other than leases out there which may be impacted by Brexit. And so while we've got orthodoxy back in the leasehold context, it wouldn't be surprising to see that there are arguments still to be made about the impact of Brexit in other contexts.
Just one other question mark that remains hovering over us with the B word.
Just one.
And your run of recent victories continued in the Court of Appeal this year in Churston Golf Club versus Richard Haddock, which was a case with which listeners might be slightly less familiar than they are with Francis and EMA. So what was the issue in that one?
So, Churston Haddock concerned this wonderful thing called a fencing easement. So usually an easement involves me having rights over your land. So, for example, a right-of-way gives me the right to walk or to drive over your land. Or they give me a right to prevent you doing something on your land. So, for example, if I have a right to light, I can prevent you building on your land in such a way as to block my light. A fencing easement is actually a bit of a misnomer because it doesn't really work like that. It's a right which enables me to require you to do something positive on your land, spend money in building a fence and or wall and keeping it up to scratch. And that's a really, really ancient right. We looked at cases going back into the 1340s, I think it was, right back into the medieval period, when, of course, having a stock-proof fence was really important so that your animals didn't escape or your neighbour's animals come in and trample your crops. And what happened in this case was that in 1972, there'd been a promise to erect and maintain a fence. And the question was this one of these peculiar medieval things called a fencing easement, or was it just a covenant, just a promise? And if it was just a covenant, then it wouldn't bind successors in title, whereas if it was a fencing easement, it would. And ultimately, the Court of Appeal concluded that it wasn't a fencing easement, it was just a straightforward positive covenant, and so it wasn't binding on successors in title.
And as I carried out my sort of little review of your recent caseload, I also saw that you've successfully obtained permission to appeal to the Supreme Court in Duval versus 11 to 13 Randolph Crescent Limited, which is another case, the name of which I recognise, an important case on leasehold covenants. Now, you weren't involved in that in the Court of Appeal, if I'm right.
That's right.
How would you summarise the point to be argued at the Supreme Court in that one?
So it relates to a clause which is very common in leases in residential blocks of flats, where the landlord promises one of the lessees that it will enforce the covenants in the leases of other tenants. And the question which is raised in this case is, if as a landlord you give that promise to tenant A, does that mean you can't grant a licence to tenant B to do something which would otherwise breach their lease? For example, if there's a covenant against structural alterations or cutting into services, does that mean that the landlord can't allow tenant B to do that without breaching its covenant to enforce other people's leases? And it's had a mixed set of decisions. So right at the beginning, the district judge said the landlord couldn't grant the licence. The county court judge said it could. The Court of Appeal went the other way and said it couldn't. And as I'm acting for the landlord, I'm hoping the Supreme Court will swing back to what the county court judge found.
Is that one that we can look forward to later this year, or will it might it go into next year?
Yeah, no, we've got a hearing in October of this year, so not too far away.
We'll keep our eyes on that one. So those are a few of the cases that have kept you busy over the last couple of years. I'm sure there are many more. Now, obviously, Francis and Canary Wharf, particularly the latter, attracted a lot more attention than most property law cases, I think it's fair to say. So, I mean, do you enjoy being involved in cases with a high profile like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there is obviously a frisson of excitement, and who doesn't love sending a newspaper piece to their mum and dad and saying, look what I'm doing. But, you know, the honest truth is that a lot of the work that my colleagues and I at the Property Bar do is actually for high-profile clients. It does actually involve interesting and difficult questions of law. It's just that the cases don't see the light of day because they settle before they ever get to a trial. So it is just really chance that you happen to be involved in a case which does go to trial and therefore gets reported rather than one that stays under wraps and can't be talked about.
I imagine it brings an extra level of excitement when you're not just looking at us property law journalists in the courtroom, but you also have the major newspapers and the television companies and what have you reporting on the case as well.
Yeah, although I think it adds an additional responsibility in terms of expressing yourself in a way that's might not be misunderstood by the general press. And the example in that was not from something counsel said, but something the judge said in the Canary Wharf case early on. He said, I'm going to assume a no-deal Brexit, meaning, look, I've got to test this question of frustration against the most extreme case. And that was taken up by some of the mainstream papers to mean that he was predicting there was going to be a no-deal Brexit, which was not at all what he meant.
And does it bring any other challenges being in that brighter spotlight for you as a barrister?
I think there is a greater awareness, particularly if it's not simply a property specialist audience of choosing your language. But otherwise, I think not really, in the sense that, you know, if you go to trial or go to an appeal hearing for any client, you're absolutely committed and you want to do your best. So the fact that it's high profile or there's a well-known client doesn't really make a great deal of difference to the arguments that you make.
What's it like, though, at the end of a case like that when you win? I mean, would you liken it to a kind of sporting triumph? Does it come with sort of personal satisfaction?
To be honest, I don't have much sporting triumph to call on. I'm not sure the sort of egg and spoon race from the primary school is going to count. I think it is probably different from sporting triumph, actually. First of all, it's really not an individual thing about the advocate. It's really a team effort. But also, how you feel about a win or a loss depends on what you thought was going to happen before you get into the case. So if you win a case that you feel sure you ought always to have won because your evidence was always best and your case in law was always best, it often doesn't feel absolutely fantastic. It's just a relief not to have messed it up. Whereas you can lose a case and feel great about it because actually the judge has accepted one of your arguments, even though overall you've always been saying to your client, do you know what, this is really going nowhere, you're not going to succeed with this. So I think it's not perhaps as straightforward as other victories and losses in worlds outside the bar.
Yeah, as for losses, I'm sure you have experienced the odd defeat along the way. It comes with the territory. So how do you, on the flip side, how do you react to setbacks if you do lose a case that you were confident in? And would you have any advice for other people out there entering sort of more junior in the profession on how to deal with that side of the job?
I mean, I must admit, I tend to take the defeats more to heart than the victories. Actually, it's really easy to beat yourself up and to think, should I have done something differently? Should I have given different advice? And I suppose what I've learned over time is that you just have to understand that cases don't usually fight unless there are two legitimate arguments. There are two sides to every case, and so, you know, on the law of averages, you probably ought to be losing 50% of your cases. But also that the advocate doesn't have control over everything that goes into winning or losing a case. You can't affect the quality of the evidence. You can't affect how your witnesses give their evidence. The judge may come with a particular view about the law that you can't dislodge him or her from. So you have to be a bit relaxed about it. I was speaking to a number of years ago, I was speaking to somebody who's now a High Court judge, and he said, do you know what I mean? Do you know what? The more senior I get, the less I think that I can predict accurately what a judge is going to decide. And I agree.
Now, your work has brought you considerable accolades. We mentioned a few from professional bodies earlier on. But also, following your victory in Canary Wharf, I note that you were named the Times' Lawyer of the Week earlier this year. Is that kind of recognition something that drives you professionally, or at the heart of it, do you just simply have a passion for property law?
I think not really. It doesn't really drive me. I mean, I think the director is, of course, it's nice to get a nice quote, but they're a bit of a fickle guide. And to me, the most important thing is that my clients feel that I've done a good job for them. And I don't need, and I think it would be pretty difficult for any barrister if they really needed that kind of external validation of their success from directories or articles to tell them that they were doing a good job, because it's a pretty fragile basis for your self-esteem, as it were. But I think having that core belief that you know you've done a good job, your clients think you've done a good job for them, that really is the most important thing. And yes, I love property law. I really, really enjoy it. But I don't enjoy it so much in a complete vacuum. I enjoy it in its application to real life circumstances. And that's what, you know, I get by being a barrister rather than academic. It's great.
And that interest remains as strong now as it was when you chose to specialise in property?
Absolutely. I feel eternally grateful for the variety and interest and intellectual challenge of my job. I'm very, very lucky.
As well as your tremendous skill as a litigator, you have acted in a number of cases resolved by arbitrations and expert determinations, and I believe you're a qualified mediator as well.
That's right.
We previously had one of your chamber's colleagues Jonathan Seatler QC into our studio to argue the merits of litigation rather than mediation in his Agenda series, a podcast I'm sure you probably heard. Where would you stand in that debate?
I'm a big fan of mediation. In the vast majority of disputes, settlement is best for the clients. And a skilled mediator can do really amazing things. I've seen great mediators bring parties together that I thought they were never, ever, ever going to settle. But the fact is you can't always settle. And most cases that go to trial have been through a mediation before that trial, but it hasn't proved possible for the parties to find a way through. And actually, it's quite important for the development of the law that cases don't settle, because the cases that go to trial and get decided by judges are the tip of the iceberg, and the rest of the industry is often waiting to know what the answer is to that particular question. And if we don't litigate them, then we never get to know what the right answer is. Obviously, on a personal level, as a litigator and as an advocate, I love being in court. So, it's always a little bit sad when my clients settle, even if I know that's the best thing for them. And I sort of feel that with all law, the ultimate test of all law is what would the judge say if this came before him or her in court? When you draft a contract or when somebody advises on what the law is, that's the test. What would somebody say in court? And if you don't get to court, you never get that sort of, confirmation of what the law is.
To get to that point, unfortunately, litigation is a time-consuming and very expensive business. Do you think more should be done to encourage feuding parties to find more efficient, cheaper ways to resolve their disputes?
I actually think there's lots done already, and the courts are very, very aware of the problems, particularly for ordinary individuals and the cost of litigation. So I don't think I've seen a case in a very, very long time where settlement hasn't been at the forefront of the discussion around strategy right from the beginning. And that includes in cases like boundary disputes or neighbour disputes, where the costs may be astronomic in comparison with what's actually at stake. And they're the ones which most obviously ought to settle. So I think there is an awareness across the industry. Good advisors will always think about settlement, and the courts do, and the judges really will encourage parties to think about settlement and talk about that actively. The difficulty is that if you want to find the right answer to something, for example, the right answer as to where your boundary is in the garden between your house and your neighbour's house, that can cost a lot of money, because it's actually quite a complex legal problem. Better sometimes just to have an answer, even if it's not the right one.
And as someone with a considerable experience of the court process, I mean, do you think there's anything that the court service should be doing to improve things for litigants?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious to everybody who uses the courts regularly that they've been chronically underfunded in recent years. And that has an impact not so much on the quality of judicial decision-making, which remains very, very good, but it does have an enormous impact on the administration of the courts. So getting your case on, getting your correspondence answered, getting your case listed, those sorts of things can be intensely frustrating, because they're just aren't the staff available to manage cases. So a lot of my clients find that very, very annoying, and it does impact on their view of the court system and their willingness to litigate rather than deal with their disputes in some other way, including arbitration, for example. But I'd say the two most significant complaints from my clients are about getting the level of judge that they feel confident will properly decide their case. So clients complain when cases that they feel should probably be in the High Court get sent to the County Court, and that happens with quite a lot of property cases, a lot of high profile and high cost, high value property litigation takes place in the County Court, and we have some fantastic County Court judges, particularly in Central London County Court, but sometimes the clients don't have the same faith. But also, if you're in the High Court, getting a deputy, a part-time judge, when you've spent thousands of pounds and waited a long time to get your case on, can be a source of complaint by clients.
Now, as well as your very busy practice, you somehow find time to be chair of the Property Bar Association. So tell us a little bit about the kinds of work that you do with the PBA and why you find it so rewarding.
I love getting to meet people from across the property bar and the profession generally. We're a pretty friendly bunch, actually, and it's really nice to chat to people of all seniorities and from different places around the country. That's very good. So the PBA, the Property Bar Association, is about supporting its members. We have about 400 members, all of whom are property barristers. We have educational events, so we run seminars. We have a big conference every year. We have social and networking events, often with the Property Litigation Association, mm-hmm. which is the solicitor's equivalent. We do outreach. For example, we have an essay competition, which we run with the States Gazette for students. But we're also always looking to find new ways to support our members. So, for example, we have a project ongoing in relation to well-being, conscious of the mm-hmm. stresses and strains of being at the bar and how that impacts on people's health and mental health. And we're also in the process of setting up a scheme which will enable us to advise members and others on harassment or discrimination issues. Mm-hmm. So it's really about supporting the property bar in all the aspects of their professional lives.
So for anyone out there who's sort of considering applying for the bar and specialising in property, I mean, how would you describe the current state of the profession? And what advice would you offer them on progressing their careers?
I think the property bar is in good shape and it's an absolutely great career. It mm-hmm. can't be said about all of the parts of the bar, sadly. but it's constantly varied. As I said earlier, it's intellectually demanding. I think property law is seen as a bit niche. Quite a lot of students think, well, I'd really like to work in human rights law, or they see themselves in commercial law, rushing around doing some case that's got an awful lot of millions in it. But for the long term, I would say the property bar is really a fantastic career. You mm-hmm. get interesting cases right from the get-go, right at the outset of your career, and they continue to be interesting, varied right through your career to the senior end. So it's great. And what I would say in terms of advice on progressing your careers, if you're a student out there, do the PBA essay competition. It'd be a great thing to put on your CV. Yeah.
And you can be involved with a fair few millions in the property sector as well, can't
Indeed,
you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So with that next generation in mind, one issue of concern when it comes to the legal profession at the highest levels is diversity. Mm-hmm. Is that a topic you yourself are passionate about, and how do you think the profession is doing on that front?
It is something I've had an absolutely lifelong interest in. Sad enough to have won a competition when I was about 12 with a poem about the suffragettes. So, gender diversity goes back a long way.
If only I'd known that, I'd have asked you to bring it in.
What I would say is the profession has started, but there's still a way to go. The bar is a very different place from the place that I started out in 1990. It has really changed. And it is a more diverse place, and there's more understanding mm-hmm. Of the importance of diversity, both in terms of providing a service to our clients and in terms of ensuring that we reflect the communities we serve. But I'm not going to pretend that we're there yet. Mm. There are lots of programs ongoing. There's a lot of work to be done in all aspects of diversity, and that is definitely very much part of the Property Bar Association's work as well. So we, for example, when we're doing an educational event, we will try and ensure that we promote speakers who may not always have seen the limelight before, mm-hmm. Not just those who are already well known as experts in their field, so that the next generation can come along, and that might be a more diverse generation than the people right at the top. And the essay competition is very important to us, that we reach out to as many students from as many different backgrounds as possible, and we monitor that. So it's not great, but it is pretty good. It's much better than it used to be, and I think we're all continuing to work on it.
I'm sure you are. So we've Obviously, we've discussed at length your formidable workload, and it sounds like you don't really leave too much time for leisure pursuits. But what does Joanne Wicks QC do to relax?
Well, I love cycling. Mm-hmm. I am very, very much a leisure cyclist. I like to say that I go at chatting speed only. But I do go out with a couple of mates on a weekly basis, and that's a really important part of my week, just to sort of get out into the country lanes, get a bit of fresh air, a little bit of exercise, and most importantly, a gossip at the end of it. I really enjoy travelling. I was explaining to you earlier that I'm recently back from a trip to Canada, and quite often my trips with my husband involve a bit of a wildlife interest. Yeah. So we went to see some grizzly bears and some great photos. Yeah, no, that was very good. But most of all, in all honesty, I'm quite a social beast, and the best thing for me is to meet my friends and have a catch up.
Okay. Brilliant. And does the cycling extend to commuting at all? Or?
No, I live quite a long way out of London, so I think I'd be you know, exhausted and on the floor and incapable of doing any work if I tried to cycle there and back again.
Right, okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Joanne, once again. And I'm sure we may well talk again later in the year once the Supreme Court has heard Duval.
Thanks very much.